Welcome, and thank you for standing by. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the question and answer session, please press star 1 and record your name as prompted. Today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. I would now like to turn today's meeting over to Brady Phillips. Thank you. You may begin.
Good afternoon, and thank you. And for those just joining, I apologize for the error in one of the telephone numbers for the toll-free number. The other toll number does work, and we just sent out a correction to people for the actual 888 number versus 800 number. So, again, sorry about that. Again, my name is Brady Phillips. I'm a public affairs specialist at NOAA's Office of Communications in Washington, and I'll be facilitating the call today. So today's call will highlight key features from the State of the Climate in 2016 report that was just released about an hour ago as a special edition for the Bulletin of the American Meteorological Society. This annual peer-reviewed report examines temperatures, precipitation, weather, and climate events experienced around the world last year in the year 2016. During the call, we'll have four short presentations followed by an operator-assisted question and answer session. During the call today, our speakers will reference specific slides from a PowerPoint presentation that can be downloaded at www.ncdc.noaa.gov/SOTC/briefings. That's B-R-I-E-F-I-N-G-S. Or you can find it on the media advisory posted on NOAA.gov. During the presentations, all participants will be muted. Our first presenter today is Jessica Blunden. She's a climate scientist at NOAA's National Centers for Environmental Information and is one of the co-lead editors of the report. Our second presenter will be Robert Dunn, a climate scientist at the UK Met Office and the co-editor of the Global Chapter. Third presenter will be Gregory Johnson, an oceanographer at NOAA's Pacific Marine Environmental Laboratory and the lead editor of the Oceans Chapter. And the final presenter will be Jeremy Mathis, director of NOAA's Arctic Research Program and co-editor of the Arctic Chapter. In addition, we will have Deke Arndt, who's the chief of our National Centers for Environmental Information's monitoring branch. And he, along with Jessica, were the co-lead editors of the report and will be available to answer other questions at the end. So we'll begin with Jessica. Jessica?
Hey, thanks, Brady. First, I'd like to just say a few more words about the makeup of the report as we get started. Each year, we bring together a lot of separate pieces together, and this helps us develop a complete picture of what's happening in our physical climate system. Our report examines a broad range of climate indicators from the atmosphere, from land, oceans, and from ice to assess climate and climate change around the world. The report also provides nation and region-specific summaries on temperature and precipitation patterns, and we include things like notable extreme climate and weather events in the report. For all this, we analyze what happened, how this compares with its history, and what types of trends are occurring. Today, we're highlighting several important climate indicators and events for you, but there are also dozens more in the report itself with a lot more detailed information. As I said, putting all this information together in a single place rather than simply reporting it bit by bit gives us a really broad and comprehensive picture of the current state of our global climate system. We would also like to note that there's a few things this report does not provide. We do not provide attribution analysis for specific events or for changes occurring in the climate system, and we do not forecast future change or provide scenarios and projections of potential future climates. So now we can get started with the content and first look at the two biggest phenomena that drove changes in the global climate system last year. So I'd ask everyone to take a look at slide 4, please. One of the main drivers in the short term is the short-term natural variation of the El Niño Southern Oscillation, or ENSO as we refer to it for short. An ENSO phase and its effects can last anywhere from a few months to more than a year. The graphic on this slide shows the evolution of one of the longest and strongest El Niños since the NOAA record started back in 1950. El Niño is the warm phase of ENSO and pretty much tends to have an increasing effect on global temperatures, among lots of other region-specific influences. Generally, the stronger the El Niño, the larger the potential impact. The El Niño that began in early 2015 was actually at its peak at the beginning of 2016 and began declining early in the year. By around May of 2016, El Niño officially transitioned back to a neutral state, which means that the surface temperatures in a specific area of the eastern Pacific Ocean where we measure ENSA, this is called the Niño 3.4 region, was less than half a degree Celsius from the 1981 to 2010 average. By the end of 2016, a weak La Niña had developed, so temperatures got cooler. In this phase, global temperatures tend to decrease. Again, the effects are generally dependent on the strength of the event. So 2016 started with a strong El Niño, but ended with a weak La Niña. And if we can move on to slide 5. The second factor that most heavily influences the climate system, and this is with respect to long-term climate change, is increasing concentrations of greenhouse gases or heat-trapping gases in the atmosphere. Last year, the dominant greenhouse gases, carbon dioxide, methane, and nitrous oxide, and you can see the evolution of each over the past few decades in the graphics on the slide, they all continue to increase and they all reached new record high abundances. The annual increases of methane and nitrous oxide were both pretty much in line with their decadal trends, but the rise in global carbon dioxide of 3.5 parts per million was the largest year-over-year increase observed in the 58-year measurement record. This brought the global average carbon dioxide concentration for 2016 to 402.9 parts per million. This obviously surpassed 400 parts per million for the first time, not only in our modern record, but also in ice core records that date back as far as 800,000 years. It's important to note that the climate system is pretty complex. Effects of the influencing factors are not always necessarily independent of each other. So if you take a look at the carbon dioxide graphic, the light orange bars that you see show where there was a moderate or a strong El Niño. And we can see that the yearly increases in the atmospheric carbon dioxide concentration tend to be higher during these periods, and this is due to the influence that El Niño has on carbon emissions through factors such as drying of tropical land regions and from forest fires. The latest El Niño definitely played a role in the record increase in 2016. Overall, on average, the global growth rate of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere has nearly quadrupled from 0.6 parts per million per year in the early 1960s to an average of about 2.3 parts per million per year over the past decade, or roughly just half a century later. I'm now going to turn the presentation over to Robert, and he's going to discuss some of the specific findings in the global system for last year.
Thank you, Jessica. Good afternoon, everyone. So now looking at slide 6 of the global surface temperature, 2015 and 2016 were clearly the warmest in the instrumental record. There are 4 data sets shown in the graphic on the top, showing the behavior of the last 116 years. All 4 of these data sets show that 2016 was warmer than 2015. There is one data set there which shows grey uncertainty bars, so the range of plausible temperatures around it at pretty 4. In this case, 2015 and 2016, they overlap, so we cannot equivalently say that 2016 is much warmer than 2015. However, these 2 years are themselves much warmer than any previous. The other thing is that it's now been the second year where global temperatures are more than 1 degree above pre-industrial levels, and these pre-industrial temperatures and conditions are defined as the average between 1850 and 1900. Moving on to slide 7, we're now looking at extreme warm temperatures over the land surface. As you can see, we don't have data everywhere for this particular measure. Data sometimes takes a while to come into the report. What we're showing is the number of warm days. So these are days where the maximum temperatures are above a certain threshold. Most of the regions which we have data for are above average for the year. And we see that in 2016, the contiguous US had heat waves in June and October, especially in the Midwest. Europe had heat waves in August and September. Prior to the monsoon in India, there were some heat waves in April and May, which set a new national record of 51 degrees Celsius in Falodi in Rajasthan. Temperatures also above 50 degrees Celsius were experienced in the Middle East, in Iran, Iraq, and Kuwait. Moving on to slide 8, we're now looking at drought. In this case, a hydrological drought, so on the whole, it's a low precipitation effect, but also includes effects from vegetation. The areas suffering from drought, similar signals will be seen in river discharge and runoff, soil moisture, and groundwater storage, depending on the season of the drought and also its severity and length. Every month of 2016 had over 12% of the land surface experiencing severe drought. These regions will be different month on month in some cases, but it was that amount throughout the year. During any El Nino, as which Jessica just talked about, the land surface is usually drier, and an expansion in the drought area was seen in one of the large El Ninos last century in 82-83, but not in 1997 and 98. However, in 2015, there was an expansion of the drought area, and this led to 2016 being one of the largest in the post-1915 record of drought area. Moving on to slide 9, we're now looking at aerosols. So these are tiny atmospheric particles such as dust and smoke in the atmosphere. And they affect the radiation coming through the atmosphere as well as how clouds form and how much rain might come out of them. We've got three plots showing the biomass and these particles from biomass burning in the top left, dust emissions in the top right, and the total in the bottom. In the top right, from the dust emissions, you can see positive anomalies, so more than expected values of dust from places which are deserts, so the Southern Sahara, the Arabian Peninsula, and the Taklamakan Desert in China. You can also see more active dust transport across the Atlantic from the Sahara towards the Amazon Basin. Globally, when comparing both aerosols and carbon dioxide emissions from burning, so biomass burning and fires, it's been lower than average, but of course, as you can see in the top left, there are some regional differences. It's been low in Indonesia because of lower forest fires and also the Amazon because of less deforestation. However, fires in equatorial Africa and Siberia stand out, and also western Canada, which would include the Fort McMurray fire, which happened in May last year. Moving on to slide 10, looking at tropical cyclones. Overall, 2016 had an above-average number of tropical cyclones globally, and three basins themselves were above average: the North Atlantic, the Eastern and Western North Pacific. Both had all had experienced above normal activity. The Australian basin was probably the least active season, so had a record low number of cyclones during 2016. I'll now hand over to Greg to look at the sea surface temperatures.
Hello. If we look at slide 11, we're now focusing on the global oceans. And the global oceans on the lower left, you can see, saw a record high sea surface temperature, or SST, in 2016. And also, if you look on the right at the black curve, record high sea level as well in 2016. And 2016 was the sixth consecutive year with a record high for sea level. So sea level in 2016, the black curve again, was about 82 millimeters or 3.4 inches above the 1993 average, and the trend of that curve is about 3.4 millimeters per year, or about a quarter inch per year from 1993 to 2016. In terms of SST, global SST was about 13 thousandths of a degree C higher than the record value in 2013. That's a trend of about 1.3 degrees C per century, which is a little bit lower than the trend from 2000 to 2016, which is 1.6 degrees C per century, and a little higher than the 1950 to 2016 trend of 1 degree C per century. So again, the increase from 2014 to 2015 was much larger than that from 2015 to 2016, and as Jessica mentioned, El Nino played a role in that, and we'll go into that a little more in detail later. But first, let's look at ocean heat content on slide 12. So 4 out of 5 analyses actually show ocean heat content fall in 2016 relative to 2015. The 2016 values are still quite near the 2015 record high warmth. And this is a plot of global ocean heat content from 0 to 700 meters and it's in zettajoules, which is 10 to the 21st joules. So this is a huge, huge number, and the oceans actually take up over 90% of the heat in the climate system. If you look from 1993 through 2016, you'll see the long-term ocean warming trend is quite robust. It's a rate of gain of about 350 terawatts. If you sum up also the warming deeper below 700 meters to the ocean floor, that is equivalent from 1993 to 2016 of more than 5 Hiroshima bombs per second. But scientists are interested in not just the trends, but the wiggles, and that 2016 fall is related to the that strong 2015-16 El Nino. And let's look at that in the next slide, slide 13. So El Nino and La Nina rearrange heat within the oceans. If you look at the upper left panel there on La Nina conditions, trade winds, the little black arrows above the ocean surface, blow from east to west over the ocean, the Pacific Ocean, and they pile up warm water in the western Pacific. So you have a surface current that flows from east to west. This draws the boundary between the warm surface waters and the colder waters deep, called the thermocline, up in the eastern Pacific and down in the western Pacific. If you look on the right-hand panel, you can see that anomalous cold water. The leftmost circle is the winter of 2007-2008. You can see that cold water at the surface and slightly warmer water beneath by the blue waters, blue colors up to the top and the more orangey colors below. In contrast, El Nino, the trade winds relax, and you can see that black arrow actually reverses direction in the western Pacific. You get a flow of warm water from west to east, and the thermocline, this barrier between the cold waters below and the surface waters, shallows in the west and falls in the east. And you can see that in the temperature anomalies on the right. The winter of 2015-2016, you have this buildup of very warm water at the surface, and then colder water below. And then during the year in 2016, that ocean surface cools a little bit. And that slows the rate of SST rise. It actually also, the ocean actually also loses a little bit of heat. In the right, though, you can see that the long-term trend is about 1.6 degrees C per decade since 2004, and that's at the surface. But even down to 2,000 meters, the ocean is warming in the long-term trend. So if we go to the next slide, slide 14, we can see a few more indicators that El Nino waned. The upper map in the upper left is current surface current anomalies for 2015. The blue colors that I've circled here in the black or on the equator indicate that strong westward flow of warm water from the eastern Pacific to the western Pacific. And if you look at the bottom right, you can see the effect of those changes. This is the change from 2015 to 2016 of 0 to 700 meter ocean heat content. And you can see this very blue conditions in the eastern tropical Pacific and the warm conditions in the western tropical Pacific. If you look on page 63 of the report, you'll find this in haiku form. Large El Nino wanes, East Pacific tropics cool, seas shed heat, low rise. And I would add temporarily. And now I'll pass it over to Jeremy.
Thank you very much, Greg. Good afternoon, everyone. This is Jeremy Mathis, and I'm the director of NOAA's Arctic Research Program. 2016 was a year in the Arctic like we've never seen before. The information that we published today in this report shows a clearer, stronger, and more pronounced signal of persistent warming than in any year in our observational record. And the effects of this warming are cascading through the ecosystem and the environment like we've never seen before. On slide 15, you can see that the Arctic continues to warm at twice the rate of lower latitudes. The red line on this figure shows the global average temperature anomaly of about 0.9 degrees Celsius in 2016, while the blue line shows that the Arctic temperature anomaly was a full 2 degrees Celsius in 2016. This warming is driving and responding to changes due to the Arctic amplification effect. Between 1900 and today, the temperature anomaly is now 3.5 degrees Celsius or 6.3 degrees Fahrenheit in the Arctic. This warming is having a direct effect on Arctic sea ice. On slide 16, you can see the precipitous decline in sea ice, especially since the year 2000, in both March maximums and September minimums. On March 24, 2016, we observed the lowest winter maximum sea ice extent in the 37-year satellite record, and the 10 lowest summer minimum sea ice extents have occurred in the past 10 years. On the right-hand side of this slide, you can see that there is a strong trend towards younger, thinner sea ice cover that is much more vulnerable to continued melting. The red and yellow colors, which indicate sea ice that is more than 4 years old, were prevalent in 1985, shown on the top panel of this figure. In 2016, though, shown on the bottom panel, you can see that these colors have nearly vanished, indicating this big transition from multi-year, older, thicker ice to first and second year ice that is much thinner and much more susceptible to melt. Warming is also occurring in the ocean in the Arctic. On slide 17, you can see sea surface temperature anomalies across the Arctic. In August of 2016, average sea surface temperatures were high in the Chukchi Sea and in Baffin Bay, in most cases upwards of 13 or 14 degrees Fahrenheit, and in the Barents Sea as high as 20 degrees Fahrenheit. On the right-hand side of this figure, you can see how these conditions compare to the historical average. In many parts of the Arctic, sea surface temperatures were more than 3 degrees Celsius above average, which is also contributing to the rapid melting of sea ice. The effects of Arctic warming are not constrained to the ocean, though, as land ice is also disappearing at an alarming rate. On slide 18, you can see the loss of ice from the Greenland ice sheet. The onset of surface melt in 2016 ranked second lowest over the 37-year record up, and the mass of the ice sheet reached a new record low in 2016. Since 2002, the Greenland ice sheet has lost almost 2,500 gigatons of ice. On the right-hand side of this figure, you can see how glaciers are also responding. Glaciers across the Arctic as a whole continue to show a negative trend with extensive loss of ice in most places, although there is some regional variability. Finally, snow cover across the Arctic has also been greatly reduced. On slide 19, you can see that in spring of 2016, a new record low April and May snow cover was recorded for the North American Arctic. There is increasing evidence that decreasing pre-melt snow mass, which is reflective of shallower snow depth, preconditions the snowpack for earlier and more rapid spring melting. And while these trends that we've shown this year are very alarming, we do know that the science of what is driving these changes in the Arctic is clear. We need to expand and improve sustained observations of the Arctic. Sustained observations help create actionable information and forecasting that's needed by people of the Arctic and other stakeholders around the world. So I'll stop there and turn it back over to Brady.
Thank you very much. And I think we're now ready to take questions from the call participants. And once you are announced by the operator, please indicate, if possible, who you'd like to answer the question. And operator, can you remind folks how to ask a question and queue up the first call? Thanks,
Certainly.
Carolyn.
Thank you. We are now ready to begin the question and answer session. If you would like to ask a question or make a comment, please press star 1 on your phone. Make sure your phone is unmuted and record your name to introduce your question. And to withdraw that request, you may press star 2. Once again, for a question or a comment, please press star 1 at this time. One moment, please. And our first question or comment comes from Seth Bornstein, and please state your company.
Yes, thank you. It's Seth Bornstein with the Associated Press. I have one for Dr. Dunn and one for Jessica. For Dr. Dunn, you talked about 12% of the land surface in every month had severe drought and 4% had extreme. How does that compare to normal? Is that, I missed a little of this. How bad was 2016 for drought patches around? Is it one of the worst, the worst? Is there a way of quantifying it? And then I have a follow-up question for Jessica.
This is Robert Dunn. Thank you for that question. So it's one of the worst years for drought. In terms of the land area, that 12%, that then been matched in 1984 and 1985. So I said it's one of the worst years in the 1950 record. In terms of what size of area that is, that's about the area, an area the size of Russia, which is quite a large area, unsurprisingly.
What's normal? I mean, what's a normal year like?
So looking in the report itself, it's on figure number 2.29. It seems to be that an area of sort of between 5 and 10% occurs usually. This isn't my area of expertise.
Okay.
But it seems to be that sort of amount. It is the largest on record, but it's not by a substantial amount in my understanding of this.
Okay. And I appreciate that. And Jessica, just for the big picture look here, I guess when you combine everything, temperature, sea level, sea ice, would you say this is one of the most extreme years we've had? I know you, for the U.S., you have the climate extreme index, but how does this, you know, if this is a state of the climate, how extreme is it? Or is it not that extreme? Or is this just sort of normal? And of course, does this, you mentioned greenhouse gases. How clear is this a greenhouse gas signal?
Very clear that this is a greenhouse gas signal, although we, like I said, do not do specific attributions as to how much anthropogenic contribution there is. Yes, this is an extreme year. Every year we're setting a lot of records. So I've been doing this for 7 years, and we've been setting records every year that I've been doing it. And when you continue, I guess, I'd like to look at it over the past few years. When you set record after record after record, it's very extreme, and it is cause for concern.
Thank you.
Does that conclude your question?
Yes, it does. Thank you.
All right. You're welcome. And as a reminder, for further questions or comments, please press *1 at this time. Make sure your phone is unmuted and record your name. And to withdraw that request, you may press *2. Once again, for questions or comments from the phones, please press *1 and record your name at this time. And we will stand by for questions or comments. And again, as a reminder, that is *1 and record your name, and it is *2 to withdraw that request. Thank you. Thank you. Our next question or comment comes from Craig Miller, and please state your company.
Hi, this is I'm with KQED Public Media in San Francisco. And I'm curious, I think that something that might be confusing for a lot of people is the distinction between sea temperatures and stored heat in the ocean. What is the significance of the two versus each other, and what are the implications of one going up or down, you know, versus the other? Sorry, that's kind of a clumsy question, but...
Hi, so this is Greg Johnson from NOAA's Pacific Marine Environmental Lab, and I'll take a stab at that. The ocean takes up about 93% of the energy imbalance that the planet currently has from anthropogenic greenhouse gases. So I like to think of it as sort of the flywheel of the climate system. It takes up most of the heat. It does redistribute that heat over interannual time scales, like what I just talked about. El Nino tends to spread that heat over the surface and increase surface temperatures temporarily. La Nina brings cold water up from the surface and concentrates the heat more in the western Pacific. And so it tends to reduce the rate of increase of surface temperatures. So I think of one as sort of generally rising more steadily and being sort of like the freight train that's moving, whereas the sea surface temperatures are tend to be a little more variable from year to year. Does that help?
Yeah, I guess what brought it up for me was seeing the slide saying that 4 out of 5 analyses show that heat content falling in 2016, but we're also saying that temperatures were a record in 2016. Ocean temperatures were a record in 2016. So it sounds on the surface of it like there's a fundamental contradiction there, even though there may not be.
Yeah, I don't think there is, and that's because you can actually move heat from the near the surface during El Nino to moving it deeper during a La Nina as El Nino relaxes, and so it's actually the motion of that heat from near the surface during the height of El Nino to a little bit deeper in the ocean as we move into a weak La Nina that gives you that change in the sea surface temperatures and the heat content. Sorry, yeah, I'm stumbling a little bit here too, actually.
But, from the long-term trend standpoint, we should keep our eye on this heat content as opposed to what's just happening with temperatures.
Well, they're both important. I mean, we live at the surface, and so the surface temperature is a very important metric. They are just slightly different metrics. The heat content is directly related to sea level rise. As the ocean warms, it expands. So you really want to track both.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. And again, as a reminder, for further questions or comments, please press star 1. Make sure your phone is unmuted and record your name. And to withdraw that request, it is star 2. Our next question or comment comes from Seth Bornstein. And please state your company name.
It's Seth Borenstein at AP again. I only did this because it doesn't sound like anyone else was asking. But for Jeremy, just a quick question. I missed your when you talked about 2,500 gigatons of ice lost, and I missed the baseline date. I'm looking at the graph, and it looks like 2008. What is that baseline date?
So it's 2002 is the baseline
2002.
Date. That goes back
okay.
to 2002.
Because if I look at the graphic on that page, it's when you're looking. Let me get back to it here. It looks like it's actually a little more, but okay, since 2002. You're at 2,500 at 2017, and in 2002 you're at plus 1,500. I mean, that almost looks like 4,000 gigatons.
So we're just doing it from that's a great question, but we're just doing it from the anomaly of zero. So it's just, you're right that the total loss is higher than that, but the way we're quantifying that figure is just looking from that zero anomaly, if that makes sense.
Okay, so but the zero anomaly year is it 2002 or is the zero anomaly year around 2008? That's what I'm trying to.
So right, so you are correct. It's the zero anomaly year is 2008, and so you're right. The total loss since that 2002 is upwards of about 4,000 gigatons. But
okay.
We're just trying to put it in the context of how much ice has been lost from that zero mark.
Okay, but so what I'm sorry to belabor this, but now I've got even more. Would I be correct to say that since 2008? Greenland has lost 2,500 gigatons, or since 2002, and it should be similar, 4,000 gigatons since 2002, right? Instead of saying 2,500.
That's right. You could say either one of those would be correct.
Okay. And just to put that in perspective, how big is – what is the mass of the GIS?
So I'll have to get back to you on that. I don't know that off the top of my head, but we are talking about a significant amount of ice and a lot of water that ice would create as it melted into the ocean. And that's what we have to keep in mind, is every ounce of ice that melts off the Greenland ice sheet is contributing directly to sea level rise.
And what, just from 2016, how many gigatons was lost in just 2016?
I think, it's on the order of, I'll have to do some quick math on that. I wasn't ready for that question.
I was trying, since much of the report is about 2016, I just want to... Yeah.
Well, I can dig into that more for you and get back to you offline.
Okay, that'd be great. Thank you.
I'll get back to you with a specific number on that.
Thank you. I'm done now. Thanks.
Thank you. And as a reminder, it is *1 and record your name for a question or a comment. Our next question or comment comes from John Myers, and please state your company name.
Hi, I'm with the Duluth News Tribune. A quick question, and I missed the very beginning of your presentation, but because we're so deep into 2017, can you say how 2017 is stacking up? Are we continuing to head in the same direction? We've seen so many big headline stories already this year. Is there any reason to believe 2017 will be any different from the last few years?
Hi there, thanks. This is Dee Garnt from NOAA NCEI in Asheville. 2017, of course, what we track in real time is not as nearly as comprehensive as what goes into this report. So we only track kind of the major indicators, and for those on a global scale, global temperature appears to be running behind 2016, comparable to 2015. I think it is safe to say it's likely that it would finish among the three warmest overall for the year. Sea ice and snow cover extent kind of continue the general trends that we've seen on a global scale during this century, and that they are generally smaller than average, especially during the warmer melt season. So 2017 is not shown any dramatic or unexpected reversal of course compared to what we've seen so far in the 21st century.
Yeah, thanks.
Thank you. And again, as a reminder, for further questions or comments, please press *1 and record your name at this time, and we'll stand by for questions or comments.
This is Jeremy Mathis from the Arctic Research Program. If I can add one more comment to that last question, we are continuing to see that the persistent warming that we saw in the Arctic in 2016 stayed around through the winter months. We set temperature records earlier in the year in the Arctic in 2017. And we see that Arctic sea ice is going to be at the near record low. We don't think it'll quite break the all-time record for minimum sea ice extent in the summer of 2017, but it's trending to be another near record low year in the Arctic for 2017.
One moment, please. And we do have a question or comment from Scott Waldman, and please state your company name.
Hi, this is Scott Waldman from Climate Wire. I just want to be clear. So what you're saying is that CO2 is essentially the primary control knob for the climate. There's no other factors here that you're identifying, correct, that could be causing these changes.
This is Jessica Blunden. For long-term climate change, that is the primary driver.
And as I understand, you probably won't be able to answer this, but is this something that you've communicated to any sort of cabinet officials? Has anyone from the White House weighed in on this report or indicated a willingness to accept its findings?
Hi there. Hey, this is Deke Arndt from NOAA NCEI again, and this report is a diagnostic report. It basically diagnoses what is happening in the climate system, puts numbers, and its intent is to provide intelligence to those sort of decision makers that you're talking about. something.
Okay. Operator, can you take the next question, please? Thanks.
Thank you. Our next question or comment comes from Seth Bornstein, and please state your company name.
It's Seth Bornstein at AP again. All right, Deke, you open the door. If this is a diagnostic report, what is the diagnosis for Earth for 2016? What's its condition and prognosis?
Hey, Seth. Thanks. Yeah, this is Deke. This report, again, it is diagnostic. That, if you'll allow me to kind of talk a little bit, it's like a mosaic, right? Many of the pieces, the tiles that go into the mosaic, represent the data sets and the analysis that all of these authors bring to the overall report. And so it is a big picture. It is a broad representative. The diagnosis is things continue to change on the large scale. We continue to be interested, like Greg said, in both the long-term trends and the wiggles in the signal. We do see a decade-over-decade trend in most of the, and nearly all of the major global variables that are consistent with what we would expect in a warming world. And in some ways, it affirms what we already know about our changing climate. But importantly, it attaches numbers, which become actionable, and it attaches numbers to the changes that we see.
All right, so let's take this one more. So if it is, as you say, changing, it sounds like you're saying changing for the worse, but I don't, maybe I'm misinterpreting it. Is it fair to say that this is Earth's fever since its temperature is warming, and is Earth getting sicker?
It's certainly changing. I don't think we would jump at the chance to ascribe a value to that change. It is changing. Change can be stressful. Most of the studies that are well outside the scope of this report have indicated that the costs of a changing climate will outweigh the benefits in the net. But there will be beneficiaries and people who struggle with climate change. So I think it's clear that the climate continues to change. Going back to that mosaic analogy, we're very thankful for all of the tiles that are very well done. Each one of those tiles that goes into this mosaic represents some fantastic work by some wonderful authors around the world, and it's a real joy to bring those together into one body like this.
Thank you. I'm done.
Thank you. Our next question or comment comes from Mark Seeley, and please state your company name.
University of Minnesota. My question's a little bit different, and any of the panelists are welcome to respond. Over the years, I appreciate that the what is monitored as well as how it is monitored has been an evolving matter from year to year, decade to decade. And in recent years, very respected scientists like Ben Santer and John Worden have published refereed articles related to other attributes that might be worth monitoring, such as the height of the troposphere, the precipitable water content of the atmosphere, the aggregate output of volcanic emissions on a yearly basis. I'm just wondering, as a group that is concerned with the measurement and diagnostic of the measurements, have you or will you consider integrating some of these other attributes into future assessments?
Hi, this is Deke. I'll take the first swing at this. I've been involved with this report for 8 years. In our recent history, we've been driven by the essential climate variables as defined by the Global Climate Observing System, which is an international body that helps designate which are the most the variables that are most connected or most identifiable with long-term and other changes. So that has been kind of our guiding post so far in the evolution. These these other variables that you mentioned are certainly valuable. I believe we would certainly welcome those. But as far as going out and proactively obtaining new data sets, we have tended to go first with the essential climate variables because it is an internationally agreed upon list, and a lot of people have done quite a bit of work to help vet that list. That's not to dismiss those others. Precipitable water, a very important variable. It certainly informs what we observe in the increased hydrological cycle, the water cycle, bigger rain, bigger drought. But the ECVs, the essential climate variables, has been our main guidance for how we build out this report to more appropriately capture the breadth of the climate system. And I'll defer to any of our other authors or editors.
Does that conclude the question or comment?
Yeah, I only ask it because there are indications over central continent mid-latitude locations like Minnesota that precipitable water may be a measurement we could use to gain more insights into the dynamics of this change. And we've certainly seen in recent decades a higher frequency of record-setting amounts of precipitable water in the atmosphere over our state.
Thanks, Mark, and sorry for geeking out on everyone on the call, but we do approximate, Mark, that variable. We do some total column water vapor estimates, which approach or at least are in the same kind of ballpark as precipitable water. So that aspect is covered in a slightly different way.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you, and thank you to all of our speakers. I'm going to wrap up the call at this point. And again, if any of the listeners have further questions, feel free to contact me. That's brady.phillips, P-H-I-L-L-I-P-S, at NOAA.gov, or my colleague John Leslie at john.leslie at NOAA.gov. And as a reminder, the actual State of the Climate Report, the highlights and the summaries can be found on NOAA.gov or on NCI or AMS websites. And if you're looking for the exact links, they can be found on the Media Advisory page, also on NOAA.gov. And please don't forget to check out some of the supplemental visualizations that have been created by our colleagues at climate.gov. And if you just go to www.climate.gov, you'll find them right on the front page. And it's also, I just wanted to remind many of you who participate in our monthly climate reports, despite the fact we did release the U.S., we had the global this week. It's already time to release the global climate highlights for the month of July next Thursday at 11 a.m. Eastern Time, and we will also have a monthly climate call also at 11 o'clock a.m. Eastern Time. And I will be sure to check the number for that one. Again, thank you for your time, and I remind the speakers, please stay on the line. And this concludes the call. Thank you. Bye-bye.
That concludes today's conference call. Thank you for your participation. You may disconnect at this time.